Hello and welcome to episode 214 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And coming to you as usual in separate locations, I'm in Boulevard Park, Washington, home of the Pelton Cast.
I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of Super Bowl 48 champion, Seattle Seahawks.
Yeah, that's not the Super Bowl we're going to talk about today.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Well, we'll get there. But before we do that, let's start by talking about this week's beer, which is timely. Because the solstice is coming up. I don't know, is it the 20th or the 21st? I haven't looked this up.
By the way, you know, it used to always be the 21st, and now I think it actually is the 20th.
Is this like when Pluto stopped being a planet?
I'm pretty sure that actually is the, that's exactly what happened.
It's very similar to that. When I was your age,
it is on June 20th.
21st. Okay. Well, there you go.
It changes, though. Like, it's at 2:43 p.m. on Saturday, June 20th.
I know.
Okay.
Usually a fixture of the solstice period is the Fremont Solstice Parade. Obviously not happening this year due to the pandemic. But we're still heading to Fremont with our friends at Fremont Brewing Company and their summer American Pale Ale.
There we go.
Fremont summer, definitely one of the strongest summer seasonals.
It tastes like tangerine flowers in a glass. So if I can read about the Fremont Summer American Pale Ale. We are a family-owned craft brewery founded in 2009 to brew artisan beers made with the best local ingredients we can find. Summer ale tastes like tangerine flowers in a glass. Endless days brewed in a nectar of barley and hops. 420 reasons to enjoy this beer. Our answer to bigger is better. Summer ale is as simple as craft beer gets. One grain, one hop, simplicity. Yet, so much more. Beer has food value, but food has no beer value. Mm. That's from VWP.
Wow. That really makes you think.
It really does. This beer, tangerine, I don't know if I necessarily get that. It's a good beer.
Definitely never gotten tangerine from Fremont Summer Ale.
I was reading that and I was like, it's got kind of a florally flavor. I was guessing that it was a citra hop, but the tangerine in particular, I'm like, I'm going to be looking for that. I mean, the can is orange.
Yes. I assume that always was to reflect the sun. I guess I didn't think that it was to reflect tangerines.
Now, I have to issue a little bit of a correction here.
Okay.
No, I don't know. I was going to say a correction. Oh. The solstice next year will be on the 21st.
Well, there you go.
And then we're coming back, and not until 2024 will it be back on the 20th. So, you know, early solstice this year.
There you go. I've learned something today on this pod. That's a new thing. Are we going to few toasts?
It's a moving target like Easter. It's just whenever they want the solstice to be.
Not exactly like Easter. It does not vary as widely as Easter if it goes between 2 days. First off, UW softball shortstop Sis Bates, who won the voting in an ESPN.com poll, is the greatest college shortstop of all time.
Pretty cool.
Bates, one of two active players on that team, along with UCLA pitcher Rachel Garcia. Daniel Lurie, the Husky of legend, probably the greatest player in program history still, I would say, with all due respect to Sis Bates.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering when I saw this list. I was like, wow, where's Daniel Lurie of Sis Bates? I mean, it was awesome to see Sis making this, but I think for our lifetimes, Daniel Lurie is the defining UW softball player.
I mean, I guess I would say that pitcher in softball, particularly because so many of them have, you know, great value as hitters as well, and that's true of Rachel Garcia, who made it as the, quote, utility player. You know, you could be, it's like quarterback in football. The greatest quarterback, you know, the greatest player in school history is probably a quarterback, but that doesn't mean you're the greatest quarterback ever. Does that make sense?
Sure.
So, like, the greatest players in Wazoo history, it's obviously either Ryan Leaf or Drew Bledsoe, right? But those aren't the greatest quarterbacks in, you know, there might be someone, I don't know that there would be someone from Wazoo at another position, but you know what I'm saying.
I don't know if that is what you're saying. It's more like, I'm trying to think of a Husky player who, it's like Steve Entman might be the best Husky player of all time, but the highest value of any Husky player would be, I don't know, Tui or something like that.
It's a little tricky to say which of the quarterbacks actually would win that competition.
Would be a quarterback. Even though Steve Entman is a better player relative to his position, he doesn't have the same kind of value.
Anyway, I think Jenny Finch, the former Arizona pitcher, won that voting with, I believe, Lisa Fernandez was also ahead of Lori, who finished third among right-handed pitchers.
Still, those are the two most famous women's softball players basically ever, two of them.
Jessica Mendoza is probably more famous than them, but yeah. Okay, a toast to Sounders midfielder.
We have not reminisced about the Colorado Silver Bullets enough.
You know what we missed? Did we miss the softball national championship when we were talking about Let's Remember some years? That's a pretty big fuck up on our part.
Just delete this. Don't let anybody know.
Oh, good point. Good point. No one mentioned it.
Yeah, nobody pointed it out.
Let's remember 2011. The day they won the championship, I was doing trivia with Storm players at Red Hook Brewery. We went out to go do that after the game ended, I think.
Nice. Yeah. I don't remember specifically where I was. Right. I remember watching. You get so sucked into the College World Series where you're just like hanging on every single pitch. I think this was 2 years ago where they were playing, I want to say, Oklahoma in the finals. Is that right?
I think 2 years ago was when they played Florida.
Or was that Florida in the finals? Oklahoma's almost always in it, so I just assume. Right. But there was a game that I think they lost 1-0. And just like I was watching it while I was driving somewhere in my car and feeling like pretty devastated by that loss.
Yeah, Florida State, I should say. Yes, the won the first game of the finals, 1-0.
Brutal. And anyway, Daniel Lorre as the third vote getter among pitchers is still extremely impressive.
Yeah, yeah, no doubt about it. No doubt about it. Let's see. Oh, UW lost to Florida in 2017 in the semifinals. And that year, Oklahoma did win it. Still unfair that Oklahoma always gets toast.
Oh, yeah.
All right. A toast to Sounders midfielder Harry Shipp, who announced his retirement Tuesday at age 28, I should say. I misread that, even though I'm looking directly at it. I think because six sounds like Shipp. Shipp plans to pursue an MBA at Northwestern's Kellogg School of Management, having most recently served as the Sounders player rep during negotiations on the new collective bargaining agreement that resulted in the league's return next month, which we'll talk about in a bit here.
That's pretty interesting. So was he injured or he just wanted to go pursue this? He was just interested in other things.
I think it was just time. And that's one of the things. And, you know, even though pay is dramatically increased in MLS, you know, if you've got a chance to start your career earlier, it can probably ultimately be more lucrative than playing in MLS through your 30s.
And I don't think just hearing that info and where he's going to school wouldn't be surprised if he ended up in some sort of management type position within soccer.
Quite possible. Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, the career path that Garth Lagerwey took. I think he got his law degree, if I recall correctly. But something similar. All right. Also, a reminder coming up on Sunday, the ESPYs will be co-hosted remotely by Seattle sports stars Sue Bird, Megan Rapinoe, and Russell Wilson.
That's Sunday.
That is Sunday.
Wow. I saw an ad for it and I was like, man, that's kind of early. Because yeah, usually, right, it's like July 10th. So they moved it up a few weeks.
They did, presumably, you know, less competition. Less programming this time, but yeah, traditionally it's like during summer league. Basically, it's always been in July since dating back to 2002.
Interesting. So ESPN's really all about filling those Sunday nights with programming.
Yes, they are.
They are. I was watching for a second the Sammy Sosa and Mark McGwire documentary that came out on Sunday.
I watched the Bruce Lee documentary the week before Be Water. That was really interesting. But it'll be cool to see what they come up with. When that show was originally announced, the idea was to focus really, I think, on, you know, heroism. And it'll be interesting to see how they also address the protests of police brutality against African Americans now that that has become such an important issue between the time this was announced and when it's actually happening. And, you know, I'm sure that will be a big part of it as well.
Yeah, I'm fascinated to watch.
All right, lastly, Lou, we're pouring one out this week for Blazers founder Harry Glickman, who died last Wednesday at age 94. Glickman put together the ownership group that secured an expansion franchise for Portland, famously getting confirmation of funding from his partner, former Seahawks founding owner Herman Sarkowski, when he returned to the room of NBA expansion chairman Abe Poland to retrieve a forgotten raincoat after their meeting. Glickman went on to lead the franchise all the way through his retirement in 1994 and was still a fixture at the Moda Center as recently as this season. So definitely sad to see him go, but a wonderful career in Portland.
And did Paul Allen buy the team from him?
I think he would have stayed on after Allen took on ownership. Still in like a role of president, but I think he would have still been part of the ownership group at that point.
Huh. So the Blazers have only had two owners, I guess now three owners ever.
I mean, I think, you know, that it was probably a little fluid in terms of, you know, who was part of the ownership group at that period. Like, I don't know what the NFL rules were at that point, but Sarkowski probably had to leave when he became the Seahawks owner.
Hmm.
So,
interesting. I was listening to the redraft on the Bill Simmons podcast that they were doing of the 2006 draft when they were talking about the Blazers ending up with possibly the two best players in that draft. You know, they didn't go number one and two in the redraft, but value-wise, it's pretty easy to argue that somebody like they had two of the best seasons individually, you know, or we were talking about Brandon Roy and his career, where it's like value from a draft pick, and he had some of the best seasons of anybody from that draft. So like his career value wasn't the same as somebody like Kyle Lowry. And I lost where I was going. Just take that out. I was up until 2 playing Zelda yesterday.
I'm definitely hear that in now. Well,
that master cycle wasn't going to get itself.
Speaking of the Blazers and looking back at history, and in this case the Sonics, should we talk about the Clyde Drexler non-trade that Bob Whitsitt brought up last week on the Truth in Basketball podcast featuring George Karl?
Absolutely. So break this down for me, because you really got deep into this. I saw a tweet about it and then called you and was like, what's the deal with this? And you're like, yeah, I talked to Wally Walker about it. You already had so much more info and apparently had posted it publicly than I knew. So what was the deal here? What was this trade going to be?
Did some original reporting here, which is a rarity for me. So Whitsitt mentioned on this podcast, obviously they talked about his exit from Seattle in the summer of 1994 because of the fact that then owner Barry Ackerley wanted him to fire George Karl, and Whitsitt refused to do it. And what's weird is that like he fired Whitsitt, but then he didn't actually fire George Karl. It's a very odd sequence of events to me. But that
what ended. Year was this?
This was 1994. It was after they lost to Denver.
And he was just like, I'm fucking done with George Karl, even though they had the best record in the league.
Yep.
Was it a personal issue between him and George Karl, or did he just not think he was a capable coach?
He was just upset they lost in the first round, and he thought they were going to win the championship.
And so he fired Bob Whitsitt. I just cannot even imagine if you were – he was the GM at the time, right, Bob Whitsitt?
President.
He was the president who – but he was in charge of player personnel.
Yes.
Who put together a roster that had the best record in the NBA, and they happened to lose a 5-game series and then to get fired because of it.
And as Whitsitt pointed out, they also had – the number 10 or number 11 pick in the upcoming draft. He said they had cap space. I looked at it. I don't think they had cap space, but they were going to have some flexibility to replace Michael Cage if they lost him as a free agent, what they did, which they did.
He meant that they had hashtag cap space.
Is that a thing? So anyways, Whitsitt then went to Portland, and he mentioned that, you know, it was the subsequent season, his first year in Portland, that they decided to rebuild, that Paul Allen told him, you know, it was time to rebuild, and Clyde Drexler at that point wanted to go to a contender after having, you know, a great career as, you know, at least until Damian Lillard, and possibly still probably the greatest Blazer ever.
He meant to say they had promo code cap space.
Oh, there you go. You really are off your game today.
I got it back.
It's easy to remember.
Oh, man.
But not for you, apparently. So anyways, so he mentioned that his first option for Drexler was to trade him to Seattle for Kendall Gill, who he had acquired with the Sonics. And then, you know, at that point was upset with Carl about his playing time and his role. That was the season where he claimed to be clinically depressed and left the team, came back in time for the end of the regular season in the playoffs, was not very productive, and then was eventually traded. So, you know, the way he phrased it on the podcast was that he was offering Drexler for Gill straight up, and that Wally Walker had refused to make the deal because he didn't want to be seen as dealing with the former Sonics GM. And Wally's recollection was a little different, suffice it to say. So he noted that the original offer was, you know, Drexler for Gill and in two first-round picks. It couldn't have been their next two first-round picks because of this Ted Stepien rule that you can't trade picks in consecutive years. But, you know, definitely more than just straight up. There was also some concern. I didn't mention this in my tweet, but Drexler had a balloon payment at the back end of his contract that would have been, like, a massive percentage of the entire team payroll, and that was something of an issue as well. And that Ackerley did prefer not to trade with Whitsitt after, you know, the acrimonious breakup. But, you know, if they felt it was a favorable deal, like, you know, something they definitely should do, that he would have done it. But they didn't feel that way. And then, you know, Whitsitt eventually traded Drexler to Houston instead.
And Wally Walker traded Kendall Gill in a package that got them back Percy Hawkins.
Yeah, it was Hawkins and David Wingate from Charlotte. So, I mean, people pointed out, now the first round picks actually probably didn't end up being that big of a deal.
Completely irrelevant.
If you look, you know, the next year they drafted Sherrell Ford at number 26. They couldn't have given up the Bobby Jackson pick in 96, like I said, because of the Stepien rule. And that one actually did work out for them because part of what they traded Bobby Jackson for was the pick that eventually became Rashard Lewis. But probably it would have been
still a second round draft pick. Like, just because it became Rashard Lewis, they could have rustled up a draft pick to be Rashard Lewis.
Well, they did actually have back to back picks as it turned out that year. But
I
don't know if they would have taken a high schooler if they didn't have back to back picks. Like,
the draft pick ended up being Rashard Lewis, but it's not like it wasn't a high value draft pick.
Well, I guess that actually was the 97 pick. So that would have been the other one they would have traded, presumably. 96 was the year they traded down and eventually just basically traded out of the first round that year because they didn't want the cap hit on their books.
Yeah, I was going to say, did the Sonics make a relevant first round draft pick between, like, GP and Kevin Durant?
I mean, Doug Christie was a relevant pick.
Or as a player that ended up on their team?
No. No, I wouldn't say so.
That's kind of wild.
Urban Johnson had a good run there.
It was a long time that, like, yes, Urban Johnson had a good run. It's kind of weird that we have fond memories of watching the Sonics, but, like, and had great seasons during that time period. But the most exciting thing that you could have as a fan is an exciting rookie.
Yeah, it's less of a concern when you have a good team.
Yeah, but, like, I mean, we didn't have that for 2 decades.
Well, Rashard was, or a decade and a half. Rashard was pretty excited as a rookie. Like, he Rashard was basically was a first round pick. He was the third pick of the second or fourth pick of the second round. So,
That's just kind of fascinating thinking about that. Because I listening to that redraft and talking about Mohamed Sene, and then thinking about sort of the circus of centers that they drafted.
Did you say all the way to Kevin Durant? Like, I mean, Luke Ridenour and Nick Collis, and like Nick didn't play as a rookie because he had shoulder surgery, so that was a bummer. But Luke was plenty relevant as a rookie.
I said what I said.
Wow. Also, Desmond Mason.
Desmond Mason is a good one. Yeah, we were excited about Desmond Mason. Okay.
Yeah, you're damned right we are.
But they pretty much, when you're talking about getting Clyde Drexler back, and I do wonder what it would have been like having Kemp Payton and Drexler on the same team, if it would have worked.
I mean, the interesting thing, Supersonic Soul broke this down, pointed out on Twitter, Hersey Hawkins' advanced stats from 96 through 98 were actually better than Clyde Drexler's, in part.
Really?
Drexler, you know, he was older. He missed a number of games in those seasons. So, and I think he was probably a better fit for what the Sonics needed because he was a better outside shooter. He was, you know, really good at cross-matching defensively. He would take the quicker guards who were way too fast for Gary Payton, but don't tell anyone that because Gary's defensive reputation is so amazing. Drexler, the arguments for making the strongest argument for making the trade is that the Sonics would have had a legit chance to win the championship in 95. It is the Rockets eventually did with Clyde Drexler, you know, if they had him that year, because you didn't get Hawkins until that summer. And then also, I think Drexler just would have been an adult in the room and a more vocal leader probably than Hawk was. Like, Hawk was the steady veteran leader, but he wasn't really the vocal presence that Drexler would have been.
Yeah, I still wonder about it, though, where it's like, you know, your initial reaction is because the Sonics didn't win a championship during that time period, and Clyde Drexler won two in Houston.
He only won
but I
one.
Don't think
he got there
Houston won
year.
Two. Okay. But I don't think you just flip Hersey Hawkins into Clyde Drexler and say this is an automatic championship team.
Probably not, but it would have been fun to see Clyde Drexler in Seattle, I gotta say. We would have been pretty excited.
It would definitely be something. Yeah, I mean, there's obviously a lot of these like near-miss trades that happened in the 90s that Sonics are involved in.
Yes. So many of them. It was a wild time in basketball. Like, I'm pretty sure there's a story about the Sonics almost getting Mitch Richmond around that time as well. I'll have to do some more reporting with Wally Walker on that one.
Report back.
Yeah, I think you mentioned that at one point.
All right, so earlier today, you went to a restaurant that I've been wanting to go to for a long time. I guess it's sort of a restaurant. It's almost cook at home. From the good folks who brought you Il Corvo, it is in West Seattle in the Log House, Il Nido. And we've talked about this, I think, on the podcast before. Was this your first time going there?
It was, yes. So they've got a market set up, and basically they've got, you know, there's a refrigerator case with pasta, different homemade pasta, depending on the day. I was a little disappointed. I was hoping they might have some ravioli, but they did not, sadly, have that. And then various different sauces that then you can take home and cook, and sides as well. Picked up some focaccia as well that was quite delicious. I think maybe even the highlight, I would say.
What pasta did you end up getting?
I forget the name of it.
Oh, okay.
But it was
what?
Like kind of like giant macaroni shells.
I had the pappardelle, it's like a wide noodle, and I love a thick noodle, you know, especially of handmade pasta, and it's like, oh, so good. It was like a pork and beef ragu, the sauce.
Yes.
And you could like smell the wine when you're, did you simmer it on your stove?
I did. I don't know if I noticed the wine so much, but I mean, it was so thick at first, and it was really quite delicious.
The only thing I wish that I would have put like either some olive oil or maybe some like, we have this buttery like canola oil. I wish I would have put some of that in it to make it like a little bit richer. But just the whole thing is incredible. To be able,
absolutely.
You feel like you're cooking at home. Like you feel like you've cooked an Italian meal, you know?
Yeah, it was like three in the ranking. It's like, oh yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no.
Well, I did something. I drove there. You just drove to my house. That's
well, you didn't
you
do anything cooking wise. Like, you didn't hand make the pasta. You know, like, all you're doing is boiling pasta, but you feel like you've handmade an Italian meal. And I think that's, it's like part of the value of it. So you like make up the noodles and then pour the sauce on top. Oh, it's beautiful. But
yeah,
that focaccia.
Yeah, it was good. I mean, this is our week of eating Seattle's most highly regarded restaurant.
Wait, I need to talk about the focaccia.
Okay.
It is just like, I don't know how they can make bread taste that good. You gave it to me in the car and I was really hungry and I was like, I'm just going to go ham on this focaccia right here. And then I almost ate the entire thing because I just kept eating it. And it's one of those things where it's like the crust is chewy, not hard, but chewy. And the inside is so soft and you can taste the olive oil and the salt. And you heated it up, right? Like, I would not – when you have perfection, you just don't want to do anything to fuck with that perfection.
I don't think that heating it is a way of fucking with that
perfection. It might have made it slightly crunchier or not as soft.
It was just great as it was.
Oh, my God.
I'm not concerned about it. By the way, we should mention, as part of that trade, I was giving you the Il Nido – supplies. You dropped off Fremont Pride Kolsch, which will be our beer next week if you're drinking along as the listener.
There we go.
So that'll be fun.
I also dropped off some Mac and Jack to Jan.
You did. That's correct. But I was saying, I think feel like this is our week of eating Seattle's most highly regarded restaurants. It's a broad week because it started on Friday.
Yeah, Friday. Traditional week.
I picked up from Addo's take-home lunches. Last week they did burgers. I saw that on Instagram and immediately went to try to go snap that up. And those burgers were delicious.
Yeah, so this was like they put the cheese right into the burger patty.
Oh, it was so good, the melted cheese. That was maybe the highlight of the burger. And with a special kind of like spicy sauce.
Ugh. Yeah, and you got crinkle fries, which I'm just...
Which I said was actually the highlight of the meal that I...
Why is the side always the highlight?
I don't know. It's science.
Why don't they make the whole meal out of the sides?
But that was exciting because other than when Chef Eric Rivera has done burgers for Lil Woody's Burger Month, that's the first time I've had his food, and that is long overdue.
Absolutely. No, I want to.
We're
going to
have chicken teriyaki is the lunch next week, so I think we're going to.
What do you mean next week? Like.
Next week.
But, like.
I don't know specifically what day.
Is the Friday?
I don't know that specifically yet.
Hold on. I have to stop. They're doing chicken teriyaki from Addo.
Can you put it on your calendar? Yeah.
Man. This is under Eric Rivera Cooks.
Yeah, or Addo Seattle.
Okay. Addo Seattle, so you can order the takeout
ADDO
from what they're doing. I'm Addo Seattle takeout delivery at home experiences. This is chicken teriyaki, is a whole thing. Well, I was planning on doing a trip up to the north end this week, and I realized I was going to be right next to June Baby.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, I could go on Sunday. We've wanted this fried chicken dinner for pretty much forever. Which I believe might now be sold out. And I was looking at it and I was like, I know that I want this fried chicken. I really, really want the fried chicken in the restaurant fresh. And so I decided I want to wait on that until we can actually go to a restaurant comfortably and safely, and decided that I would rather on Friday get the prime rib and red velvet cake.
Yeah, the red velvet cake is really a highlight here.
I'm so excited. We're going to be picking that up on Friday. I am so excited for this. It's like, we know that prime rib is going to be delicious. It basically cannot be done wrong. And then a red potato salad with a watermelon salad on the side, but then the red velvet cake. I'm so excited for this on Friday.
Me too. I mean, long overdue again. Same thing. To go back to Addo for a second, by the way, I was told by the listener via Instagram DM after we posted about that, that their Hiburrito sandwich is the best. Wow, using fried plantain as a bun is the best sandwich in Seattle. So we may need to retroactively throw that into
plantain as a bun.
Yeah.
Where were you last summer, listener?
Where were we is actually probably the better question to ask.
That's a really good point. Man, I'm like, the idea of eating is like, you said it was, what was the website you said for Adam?
It is ericriveracooks.com.
Okay. /Addo. Yeah, eating good food is like really getting me through these last couple of weeks. Like, I don't know. I just needed this right now.
Okay. Let's get into our restart and return to play update. Starting with NHL Seattle news, NHL Seattle CEO Todd Leiwicki told the Seattle Times that the opening of the new arena has been pushed back to August to mid-September of 2021 due to pandemic-related delays. This is most notably impacting the Seattle Storm if the WNBA returns to home markets in 2021, is they would have to again be dislocated from the arena before maybe being able to move in mid-season based on that timetable. But a lot still to be determined about what's going to happen in 2021. We'll talk about the WNBA's plan for the 2020 season in a bit here. It also probably rules out Seattle hosting the expansion in amateur drafts in the summer of 2021, though the timing of those does remain uncertain with the 2019-20 NHL season pushed
back.
Damn
it. Okay.
All right, Mariners news. As we mentioned last week, first off, baseball. Get your shit together. Come on. Come on, Rob Manfred. Maybe not. No one should have to watch baseball. The Mariners drafted right-handed pitcher Emerson Hancock out of the University of Georgia with the number 6 pick in last Wednesday's MLB draft, then took two more college pitchers among their 5 draft picks in this year's shortened draft.
I actually ended up randomly watching some of this draft.
Did you?
I don't know why.
I saw the intro because it came on like after I was watching something else and I just had the channel on ESPN.
It seemed like this is, I knowing nothing about it, people seem pretty lukewarm on the Seahawks or on the Mariners draft pick.
I mean, you know, it's the baseball draft.
Exactly.
That
really was the shocking part about the McGuire and Sosa documentary was how central of a focus baseball was on the national attention, especially regular season baseball. It's like, man, this feels like it was forever ago.
I mean, it's weird because that record just doesn't have the same significance anymore because of the steroid era and the fact that it hasn't, you know, been standing for decades and decades like it was with Maris. And like there was the every summer, it's like, oh, will someone do this? Like Griffey when he started out hot and was on pace to do it in 94. And then I think he was on pace to do it again in 96, but or 96 or 97, but tailed off and didn't come all that close. So it's kind of funny because like everyone assumed Griffey was going to be the guy to do it if anyone did it, or maybe. But then Sosa comes out of nowhere along with McGuire to make it a two-player race in 98. I still remember.
Griffey still did it in our hearts.
For sure. I can still remember where I was when McGuire, like, I was in our grandparents' back room watching that little TV with our cousin Kyle when McGuire hit his record-setting home run.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't know. I remember being at David Pelton's house when that last weekend when he got to 70.
That's possible.
I mean, we were there. There, it wasn't possible that happened.
It's likely, yes. All right, moving on to MLS. The MLS is Back tournament will run July 8th through August 11th at ESPN Worldwide of Sports Clicks at Walt Disney World, which is, of course, also where the NBA is planning to play. There will be three games per day during the group stage, which will count towards MLS regular season standings at 6 a.m., 5 p.m., and 7:30 p.m. Pacific time, obviously due to the midday heat in Orlando. Each team will play three matches, and the top two teams from each group, along with the four best third-place teams, will advance to a four-round knockout stage, similar to the World Cup, with no extra time to go directly to penalties, much like the CONCACAF Champions League, as we learned back in February, back when we attended sporty events. Mm-hmm. The winner will earn a spot in the 2021 CONCACAF Champions League, and teams will be allowed five substitutions per match to account for both the heat and, you know, players coming back from this extended layoff. The Sounders were awarded the top seed in Group B, one of the three Western Conference groups, alongside LAFC and Real Salt Lake, with the other two top seeds based on last year's standings, and were drawn into group, like, as I mentioned, Group B, with FC Dallas, the San Jose Earthquakes, and Vancouver Whitecaps will be their opponents in the group stage.
All this kind of feels like the World Cup, all the way down to having a match that's so early we'll never pay attention to it.
Yes. Yes, that is very on brand.
And having it be a contained tournament over the summer, it really means that everything is going to be way... This is the best thing that could have possibly happened to MLS soccer.
I think quite possibly so. I mean, they're going to be... You know, NWSL will be back before them, but they'll be the second... You know, team sports league back, I think. And we'll have about 3 weeks all to themselves before NHL and NBA potentially get up and running. I guess depending on what MLB does, but doesn't seem like they're anywhere close.
So yeah, I think it's kind of awesome. But also, every game will have stakes. And that's what, like, this time period for Major League Soccer would be extremely low stakes normally. Like, we would be talking about this and we'd be like, the Sounders won or they lost or they drew and it doesn't fucking matter for another 3 months.
Sometimes, like, we'd be ruling them out of the playoffs on the 4th of July and then they'd go on to dominate the rest of the season.
Yeah, we'd be in that window right now. But it would just be like, the Sounders played a match.
And also, they've been playing for 3 months.
Jesus Christ. I mean, it's kind of like hard to remember that they actually did play regular season matches.
Right.
They played
a very long time ago. An
ill-fated regular season match that should have never happened at the beginning of March.
We haven't been able to trace a specific outbreak there, but yes, ill-advised, certainly.
Yeah, I mean, sure, you can't. We don't think that it was a super spreader event, but it was just like, for who, for what? Like, why did this match happen? It was pretty clear that the writing was on the wall at the time of what was going to go down eventually.
Yes. It was a matter of when, not if.
And they decided to. But now, with MLS coming back, and you're like, well, I can actually pay attention to every match and feel like there are real stakes to it. It might even make it interesting to watch other Major League Soccer teams.
That's what I was going to say, is because the thing that the MLS has going against it, I think... You know, they have great support in a number of markets, obviously, including Seattle. But similar to baseball, it's a very local sport, as opposed to, like, the NBA and NFL are more about the entire league to you. So, yeah, I think it definitely does make it more interesting to watch non-Sounders MLS matches.
Yes. When you can have stars break out. I mean, in the World Cup, players who are massive stars already become bigger stars during the World Cup.
It's probably because the entire world is watching. I don't know if the entire world will be watching MLS.
But there's something to it being a contained tournament where you're like, this player excelled in this contained period of matches that I'm paying attention to.
And this period of matches that are of heightened importance.
Yeah. So I wouldn't be surprised if there were players from Major League Soccer who became bigger names because of this tournament.
Yeah, that makes sense. The Sounders returned to full training last Friday and helped replace Harry Shipp with his retirement by signing midfielders Josh Atencio and Ethan Dobelaire as homegrown players. Atencio played for the Tacoma Defiance in 2019, well, Dobelair has been part of Sounders FC Academy, so a couple of additions to the roster. The Ring continue to practice in Missoula as they prepare for the NWSL Challenge Cup, which is coming up in just a couple weeks here. Their first match actually will be 2 weeks from today.
There we go.
Tuesday, June 30th at 7 p.m. against Sky Blue FC. Other preliminary round matches, as we already mentioned, they'll be playing on the 4th of July against the Washington Spirit at 9:30 a.m. Pacific time. Wednesday, July 8th against the host Utah Royals FC at 9:30 a.m. And then their final match of the preliminary round on Sunday, June 12th against the Portland Thorns at 7 p.m. Also on the women's soccer front, U.S. soccer repealed its rule banning kneeling during the national anthem. And new U.S. Soccer Federation President Cindy Parlow Cohn said Friday that in a private phone call to Megan Rapinoe during a conversation about the change, she apologized to Rapinoe for the rule and basically singling out Rapinoe, who began kneeling in solidarity with Colin Kaepernick in the early days of his protest in 2016. To quite a lot of backlash in the soccer world.
There we go.
Yeah. We mentioned this earlier, but the WNBA is back. The WNBA Players Association on Monday approved the league's 22-game proposal to play the 2020 season at IMG Academy in Bradenton, Florida. Teams will head directly to Bradenton for training camp, different from what NBA teams are doing, starting in early July with the season set to tip off on July 24th and a full playoffs wrapping up in early October. So exciting news for the Storm, certainly, to have a chance to win a championship. You know, we'll see if for sure that Sue Bird is part of this, but you know, you would think that with her time limited that she would want every opportunity to try to win with this young core of, you know, talented players that wasn't able to play together last year due to her injury and Brianna Stewart's.
Yeah, that's interesting. So are they going to all be in a bubble, so to say, similar to the NBA for that extended period of time?
So we haven't gotten full details on the protocols, but the league will be providing housing in the same way.
Will they be able to play doubles ping pong?
I have not heard about that yet. I don't know if we mentioned this last week. A big change from the first offer that the WNBA made to its players. Originally, they were offering, I believe, 60% pay. Now players are getting full season pay. And then the other thing is that players with at least 5 years of experience will be allowed to bring a guest with them into the bubble here at IMG Academy. So they won't be completely isolated from their family in the same way as NBA players will until after the first round of the playoffs. So one player who won't be there is the WNBA starts anew its season is UW legend Kelsey Plum of the Las Vegas Aces, who ruptured her Achilles in a weekend workout and will miss the 2020 season.
Oh, that sucks. All right.
Yeah, tough news. I mean, Plum, you know, I think this was going to be a big season for her to establish herself in Vegas. And, you know, another team that has realistic title aspirations after adding Angel McCautry. So, yeah, disappointing to not see her out there.
Oh, I'm just finding out about this from you right now.
You're just retweeting it from the Pelton Caston account.
If it wasn't 2 a.m. last night, well, it was. Oh, man.
Yeah. So we'll have more time to talk about that. See who exactly. I mean, there's probably going to be some players who will elect not to play. I believe my ESPN colleague Michelle Vopel reported that proposal passed with 77% of the vote. And, you know, that doesn't necessarily correlate exactly to who's going to play or not, but does suggest that not everyone is on board with that idea.
Just because it doesn't pass with 100% of the vote doesn't mean those players are not going to play. I mean, there was a thing in the NBA where players could choose not to play and then would get paid 1/92nd or whatever of what their contracts were.
They would get docked that for each game they missed up to a maximum of 14.
Ah, interesting.
Yeah.
I would assume that most players are going to end up playing if it happens.
I would think so, but it's tough to say for sure. UW Athletics, returning athletes in football, men's and women's basketball, volleyball, and men's and women's soccer back on campus this week for phase one of their reopening. They'll be allowed to participate in voluntary outdoor fitness activities in groups of five or less at various, you know, they're apparently putting the weight equipment on the concourse at Husky Stadium so that it can be distanced and be outdoors, but you can have a number of players there working at one time.
On the concourse?
Yeah, I think so.
Like there was a lightning storm happening? Everybody's huddled in there?
But similar to that, hopefully there won't be a lot of lightning during the day. The forecast looks good as we move into summer soon here.
Is this just football players or is this all athletes and all sports?
I just listed the sports.
But I'm saying, is it all of those athletes from all those sports who are working out at Husky Stadium?
Yes, because you can't go into the actual physical weight room right now.
Yeah, where are they anticipating that? They're anticipating that the players are living. Are the dorms open at UW?
I think they are for athletes. And, okay. You know, because of the fact that that's a smaller group of people, therefore you've got the ability, presumably, to space them out a bit more than you would normally.
Okay. I'm surprised to see this, though.
Yeah, I mean, it's been said that kind of part of the logic here is it's safer for players on campus where they can be tested and monitored in a way that, they're not necessarily if they're at home.
So we're basically full steam ahead for a football season happening, a college football season happening.
We're on track for it, I think it's fair to say. So the incoming football recruits will be part of the next group of players to return to campus next week.
Okay. And the anticipation as of this moment, I mean, nobody's announced anything, but there's almost no way they're going to be fans of these games.
It doesn't seem realistic.
And so they would still hypothetically play the games in the locations that they're scheduled in. Because you couldn't, with all of college football, you couldn't put everybody in a bubble, obviously.
No, a bubble wouldn't make sense.
And so the games would still happen in the locations they're scheduled in. But there wouldn't be any fans there.
I think that's the appropriate presumption right now.
Okay. That's it's going to be interesting.
It sure will.
We're going to have some very different reaction pods this year.
Yes, we are. Not a lot to say in terms of return to play in the NFL, which, players still not allowed into team facilities. But should take note that several Seahawks, including Coach Pete Carroll and GM John Schneider, were involved in Saturday's Bridge to the Future march across Lake Washington floating bridge organized by Natalie Wright and Tiffany Chancellor, whose husbands were teammates with the Seahawks. All right, so should we stay with the Seahawks and talk about 2014? I don't know how much we've actually talked about this.
You have to introduce it. You always forget to introduce the years.
Fine.
Okay. This is talking about our sponsor. How about you now, all of a sudden?
It's time to remember 2014, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza.
Because Pagliacci Pizza are going back-to-back to the Super Bowl. And so are we in 2014.
Oh, boy. Well, it started on a high note. The Seahawks opened the 2014 regular season hosting Green Bay in the traditional Thursday night opener and coming up with a 36-16 victory, scoring 19 unanswered points after the game was tied at 10 in the second quarter. Aaron Rodgers was held to 189 yards on 33 attempts as he never threw a pass in Richard Sherman's direction in that game. Really a look at the future of Aaron Rodgers' career.
That game was so much fun.
It was very fun.
The Thursday night, the first couple weeks of the NFL season are some of the most fun weeks. You're just excited that football is back. It's still sunny outside.
Nice. Yeah,
it was like a beautiful day. We're celebrating winning the Super Bowl, playing the Packers, and winning the game comfortably, but also the part about Rodgers not targeting Sherm. And it was just like Sherman is in. We definitely thought he wasn't going to win the Defensive Player of the Year because he wasn't going to get numbers because nobody was going to throw at him.
Yep, pretty much. So that high lasted 1 week as the Seahawks then lost 30-21 at their nemesis, the San Diego Chargers. Phil Rivers, their nemesis, then needed overtime to win a Super Bowl rematch versus Denver in week three that we expected to be that Thursday night matchup, but they saved for a little bit later after a late Peyton Manning touchdown as part of a furious comeback from a 17-3 Broncos deficit entering the fourth quarter. The Seahawks then lost back-to-back games, home versus Dallas and at St. Louis, thanks to a Johnny Hecker fourth down conversion to slip to 3-3 on the season.
And quickly on that Broncos game, really emblematic of what we've seen from the Seahawks defense over and over and over again during this era. That drive that he
had. Except during the 2013 NFC Championship game.
Yes, holding up in that one. I mean, they still let the Niners drive down the field. They just got one big play. But, like, being able to drive, you know, it was Matt Ryan, it was Peyton Manning, it was Aaron Rodgers. It just happened over and over and over again in this defense. But that touchdown drive that the Broncos had, if I'm recalling this correctly, it was like 23 seconds. It was one of the fastest touchdown drives we've ever seen. Just like, whoa. It was one of the, you like get your hair knocked back. You're just like, whew, okay. Well,
there was a busted coverage. They ran some sort of like a switch verticals play is my vague recollection. I mean, not seen this play in 6 years.
It's all right. We called a Marshawn Lynch fumble at quarterback sneak last week. So.
No, we're gonna get to that, good sir. We're gonna get to that. Let's see here. Oh boy, it was a 41-second drive. Hauschka kicked a field goal at the 59-second mark to make it an 8-point game, and they in 41 seconds scored and then got the 2-point conversion to tie it.
Well, what did I say? 26 seconds. That was pretty close.
You said 23, I think.
That one just. That drive, seeing that, was just like, Jesus, okay.
There was actually the amazing thing. It was 47 seconds. There were two incomplete passes and a spike. They never took a timeout on that entire drive and scored in 41 seconds.
It was the most Seahawks defense drive.
The two, there were only two completions, a 42-yarder to Emmanuel Sanders and then a 26-yarder to Jacob Tammy for the touchdown.
Wow, Jacob Tammy. All right.
Okay, so the Seahawks won 13-9 at Carolina to start a three-game winning streak. And then after a loss at Kansas City, who looked dominant at that point, won the season's final six games, highlighted by a 19-3 win at San Francisco on Thanksgiving.
Oh, my God.
It's Richard Sherman and Russell Wilson walked off the field eating turkey legs.
Them eating just piles of turkey on the 49ers field. I mean, this basically ended Jim Harbaugh's tenure in San Francisco.
It was just a great year for the Seahawks to play on NBC on Thursday night because the Packers game and that 49ers game.
We were tense going into this game, too. I think the Niners went into a huge slide after this. But they were still an extremely good team going into that game. And we really, it's funny because, you know, obviously the Niners dynasty has come roaring back. But at the time, we felt like that was it. We have slayed the 49ers. They're done.
Had slayed that version of the 49ers. Both those teams came into the game 7-4. So it was for the NFC West lead, and it started a four-game losing streak for the 49ers before they won their meaningless season finale at Arizona to get back to 8-8. Also included in that losing streak, of course, a 17-7 loss to the Seahawks in Seattle. And the Seahawks, the six-game winning streak, locked up the number one seed for the second consecutive year in the NFC. In the division round, they faced the Carolina Panthers for the third time in the past two seasons, winning 31-17 behind three Russell Wilson touchdowns. Cam Chancellor with a late 90-yard interception return.
Sealing it.
Yeah.
Cam going back the other way. Pretty Cam sealed, on as Cam it turns violence. Out.
This was also the game where Cam Chancellor. Awesome play, this was also the game where Cam Chancellor leaped first. Did the leaping over the center?
That
play.
Was the Panthers game.
Yeah, but
I mean, that, it was a
he got
that,
called
this was
for
a
penalty.
Pretty fun game. Yeah, I think the refs are just like, "What the fuck was that?"
Well, no, he ran into the kicker.
Oh, after jumping over?
Yeah, it wasn't because of the jumping. It was a running into the kicker, so he blocked the kick, but they got a second chance and then made the field goal at the end of the first half. That he was also doing it at the end of the half because there was no potential for them to like go for it and score. Yeah,
interesting. But yeah, I mean, I definitely will never forget. It was right in front of us when Cam picks that ball up, and it just happens so fast. Like the pass is thrown, and then instantly it's intercepted, and he's gone down the field. And that's one of the most fun plays that you can see, where you're like backed up to the goal line, or you know, they're in the red zone, and then the ball just changes directions, and there's nobody within a mile of Cam Chancellor.
All right, that set up the NFC Championship game against the Packers, a rematch of that opener. The Seahawks trailed 16-0 at halftime. Is the offense one of the slowest starts we ever saw from the Seahawks offense. And the defense wasn't so hot either, but Green Bay settled for field goals of 18 and 19 yards in the first quarter. The Seahawks finally got on the board with a 19-yard John Ryan touchdown pass to Gary Gilliam on a fake field goal.
Wow. John Ryan to Gary Gilliam.
Yeah, Gary Gilliam converted tight end to offensive lineman that time, paying off. He was George Fant before George Fant was George Fant.
They both went to Penn State too, right?
No, George Fant did not. He went to like Western Kentucky.
Oh, I guess I was just thinking of Gary Gilliam. I remember playing a college football video game with Gary Gilliam as a tight end.
So that wasn't until the 4:44 mark of the third quarter that the Seahawks scored at all. Early in the fourth quarter, with 10:53 left in the game, Packers add a fourth Mason Crosby field goal to go ahead 19-7. And
the game's over. The game is over at this point. Like, we're sitting there. It has been the Seahawks have been able to generate no offense. Their only touchdown is because of a trick play. It's just a terrible day. Russ is being hounded. And, like, Russ wasn't Russ for most of this game. Like, this wasn't the Russell Wilson that we had come to know before. This was before we even knew that if Russell Wilson was touched by rain, that he became a different player.
Did it rain that day?
Oh, did it rain that day? It was terrible. It was just, like, it was wet and it was cold. I mean, it was fucking January or whatever. In Seattle, like this was normal weather. It was also a late game too.
Yes.
So, and the sun sets in January in Seattle at 2:30 p.m.
No, actually, it was an early game. It was 3:30 Eastern.
So this was the first game?
Or 3 Eastern? Yeah, it was the first game.
Oh, we came back and saw the Patriots dismantle the Colts.
But there was actually a lot more lows to happen after they went down. By that 22-7 score, they punted at the 50 with 7:01 left. They got the ball back with 5:13 left near midfield, and then Russell Wilson was intercepted again on another pass intended for Jermaine Kearse. And Packers punt the ball back with 3:52 left. The Seahawks take over at their own 31, down 15 points. They score a touchdown just on the correct side of the 2-minute warning. Still onside, decide to onside kick because they've already used two of their timeouts on that previous series that the Packers had the ball. Chris Matthews, which is a name none of us know at that point, recovers the onside kick, and the Seahawks then very quickly.
Who is the Packers player? Was it Richard Rodgers? Is that right?
I don't think it was. It might have been, though. But I thought it was someone who wasn't still part of the team. No, Richard Rodgers, it was Brandon Bostic. Richard Rodgers actually recovered an onside kick that the Seahawks once had against the Packers.
Oh.
So that's probably what you're thinking of. So the Seahawks march down and score quickly. A little too quickly, as it turns out. With a minute 33 left, Marshawn Lynch breaks off a 24-yard touchdown. And then the two-point conversion, one of the most amazing plays in Seahawks franchise
also,
history.
Also, the touchdown before then of Marshawn walking into the end zone. Just the coolest shit we've ever seen. Right? To take the lead in the NFC, the most improbable lead that they've taken. Marshawn Lynch is walking into the end zone. There's never been a cooler moment in the history of sport.
I mean, maybe not even the, it might not have been the coolest Marshawn Lynch moment.
No, but it was just like cold. It was like Marshawn Lynch walked into the end zone to take the lead in the NFC Championship game. Nobody does. That is such a beast mode thing to do.
Yeah. So then the Seahawks go for the 2-point conversion to try to. Did I say it was 22-7? It was 19-7, I guess, when they scored that last field goal. So then the Seahawks go up 20-19, as you mentioned. Go for two to try to make it a 3-point game. Russell Wilson runs all the way backwards to about the Seahawks 20-yard line and throws like a 20-yard pass for a 2-point conversion to Luke Wilson. So one of the most amazing plays.
I'm looking at an NBC Sports Northwest remembering the 2015 championship game, and there is Ben Baldwin's tweet about the game.
What did he say?
He was posting a video of the John Ryan pass.
So the Seahawks left a minute 33 on the clock. Aaron Rodgers marches the Packers down to the Seahawks 30-yard line.
We knew it was coming. We knew this was coming. I mean, we'd seen it earlier in the year. Like I mentioned to you, we had seen it with Peyton Manning earlier in the season, and it was like, this is happening instantly. We were thinking to ourselves at the time, just don't let them score a touchdown. Let's just get to overtime.
Yes. Mason Crosby kicks his fifth field goal of the game to tie it. Seahawks kneel it out, head to overtime, win the coin toss, and march down the field just by taking over at their own 13. A 35-yard completion from Wilson to Doug Baldwin on 3rd and 7, and then from the Green Bay 35. Jermaine Kearse, who previously in that game had been targeted like 6 times and not caught any of them, I think. I don't know if target data is on here, on this Pro Football Reference box score that I'm looking at. Oh, yes, it is. Had been targeted, yes, 5 times, had not caught a pass, and I think maybe all 4 of the interceptions had been thrown in this direction. I'm pretty sure all 4 of them. The Seahawks went to the Super Bowl with Russell Wilson throwing 4 interceptions, and Pete Carroll is obsessed with avoiding turnovers. I don't get it, guys. Catches the 35-yard touchdown pass, and the Seahawks head back to the Super Bowl.
Oh, man. It's just both of these years, having these games to go to the Super Bowl, having the last game in Seattle being 2 of the most memorable games that we've ever seen. You know, this is the most memorable comeback, obviously, in Seahawks history that we're seeing, and then the previous year having the most iconic play in Seahawks history, but Kearse catching that ball.
Most iconic play in Seattle sports history, perhaps.
Turning and throwing it into the Hawks nest, throwing the ball in the Hawks nest. It's just like, all right, you know, we're watching it from pretty far away,
it was in the other end zone, wasn't it? It wasn't in the Hawks nest, was it?
It was not. It was in the Hawks nest. It was opposite to me. To our seats, and he catches it, and you're like, I guess there was no doubt that he caught that ball, because he just turned and threw it into the crowd, so that better be a clean catch.
No, it was not. I'm looking at the replay right now. That's not at the Hawks Nest. You can see the Hawks Nest on the opposite end in the background.
No.
Yeah, I'm looking at the video. Are you accusing this of being a Mandela effect situation?
Let me see this. Hold on. I watched this game. I maybe...
You hypothetically attended this game. No, it 100% was into the closed end of the field. I'm looking at multiple angles of it. We've just bogged down the podcast that you can be convinced.
I'm just so baffled. Wait. I sit on the open end of the field?
No, you sit on the closed end of the field. You don't.
That
sit
was
in the
right in front of me. I remember this play distinctly happening at the opposite end of the field.
I mean, the touchdown to tie was there to go ahead in regulation was at the other end of the field. So maybe that's what you're remembering. I'm
going to text Chris about this and just ask him which side it happened on.
I'm very curious to see what he says about this.
Wow, I remember this just. It's, I guess it's strange how memories can do that. But like when I picture this play, seeing this play live in my head, it is to the opposite side of the stadium, not in front of us.
So the Seahawks went on to face New England in the Patriots' sixth of nine Super Bowl appearances in the Brady Belichick era. But in some ways, this wasn't the Patriots that we think of now because they hadn't won a championship in a decade. The Seahawks were the much more recent champions. They had lost their previous two Super Bowl appearances to the Giants in both 2007 and 2011. The game was tied at 7-7 and 14-14 each in the second quarter, and the latter was the halftime score after a Chris Matthews touchdown
Chris Matthews
late
so
in the first
good.
half, had four catches on 109 yards on for 109 yards on five targets after never previously having caught a pass, filling the void left by Paul Richardson's ACL tear during his rookie season in the win over Carolina in the playoffs. The Seahawks opened up a 10-point lead after the third quarter with the Doug Baldwin touchdown on his only catch of the game, but the Patriots pulled within three with a touchdown with 7:55 left and then took the lead on a Julian Edelman touchdown with, fittingly, 2:06 left. The Seahawks drove quickly with a 31-yard pass to Marshawn Lynch and a 33-yard pass to Jermaine Kearse, coming up big yet again, hashtag Kearse Crew, down to the 5-yard line.
Not just a pass to Jermaine Kearse, like an incredible catch. I mean, if the Seahawks end up winning this game, this is one of the plays that we look at
For
as
sure.
like him falling to the ground, reaching out, pulling it off the ground, and coming up with the catch.
Should we talk about it? So we were watching this at our cousin Chris's house, a group of us. And I mean, it was a weird moment because it's like, no, we're gonna win the Super Bowl again.
Yeah.
Like, everyone's thinking this. Marshawn runs for 4 yards on first and goal, followed by Belichick inexplicably letting the clock run, even though the Patriots should have been calling a timeout to try to preserve time to get the ball back and inevitably score after the Seahawks did.
So if they call timeout, what changes about the Seahawks thinking? Anything?
Yeah, I think they're much more likely to run because, so, I mean, the one thing that happened here is, okay, let's, I mean, now we're into it. It's second and goal at the one. 26 seconds left, or like a little bit more than that as they actually run the play. So in that situation, the Seahawks have one timeout left. They want to pass the ball on second down so that they save the timeout for third down. You've got either the run or pass option there. And then fourth down, obviously, you can do whatever. So that is the one thing Belichick accomplished by not taking a timeout, is that he made it more likely the Seahawks would pass on second down. So let's talk a little bit about Marshawn Lynch's the Seahawks' success rate on plays at the goal line. If we go 2012 through 2014 before this play, according to Pro Football Reference, the Seahawks had run it 28 times with Marshawn Lynch in those situations, scoring 12 touchdowns, that's 43%, with two fumbles by Lynch, including in the playoffs at Washington, as Ben Baldwin pointed out to us as we were talking about that play that we misidentified last week, as well as that play in the 2013 NFC Championship game where the fumble was attributed to Wilson, which is why we called it a sneak, but it was actually just a botched handoff between him and Marshawn. So they'd thrown the ball 13 times at the one or the two and goal to go and had scored five of those, 38%. So it's well within the margin of error there, which was actually more likely to result in the touchdown, a run with Marshawn or a pass. I mean, obviously from the one, it's probably a little more likely to score with a run than a pass. But this idea that like, oh, if they had run, they definitely would have scored a touchdown, it is complete hindsight. What real Seahawks fans, like the thinking Seahawks fan will tell you, is the real mistake was not that they passed. It was that they called like a straight pass and a relatively risky pass that required, I think, Kearse to come up with a block. Also, they were targeting Ricardo Lockett, of
Ricardo
people.
Lockett!
It was like basically a career special teamer. Who, you know, sadly had his career cut short by injury the next season, unfortunately. But That was the time to rule Russell Wilson out and give him a run pass option. Like, it's Russell Wilson. He's going to make the right decision. You're just not going to weigh in on this at all, or are you going to be texting Chris? How long is this text?
I'm not texting Chris, no. I'm just a little haunted by it.
We got to confront our fears here. Especially because dumbasses on Twitter still are like, literally anytime anyone makes the balls at the 1 yard line metaphor, like, I remember this being tweeted about Melo getting traded to wherever he was going to get traded, the Rockets, I guess, in the summer of 2017.
Uh-huh. And they're like, the balls at the one or whatever. We just need to get it over the line.
Yeah, the balls at the one on this deal. And then like 8 million Seahawks Super Bowl 49 tweets. And then should have run it with Marshawn tweets. Like, we got to confront this.
I think that they were good.
People haven't thought about
it. It was just an improbable thing happened. You know?
Yeah.
Like, I don't remember. I'm sure this must have happened at some point. Russ throwing picks that close to the goal line.
I mean, it hadn't happened on any of the other passes they've thrown that close between 2012 and 14.
Sure, and obviously it's a very unlikely thing to happen, but I think Pete correctly remembered some of these fumbles that had happened with Marshawn at the goal line. You know, you obviously still trust him. Like, I don't think either way we would have been happy with the decision, but having the pass with the eventual chance of running on third down and then whatever on fourth down was the right way to approach it.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the other thing, though, is the timing aspect is what Seahawks defenders apparently needed to be told about. They needed to have this conversation because this bizarre idea that possibly Marshawn himself, this bizarre idea that the Seahawks passed it because they wanted Russ to be the MVP of the game and not Marshawn Lynch.
It's just such fucking horseshit that you would even be thinking about that. If you are Pete Carroll, Daryl Bevel, whomever is making these decisions, all you're thinking about is getting that ball in the end zone however you can do it. There's correct. No part of you that's just like going through the steps of who becomes the MVP once that happens. Like, that is, it is not part of the decision-making process. And it's a ludicrous argument to even consider. But like, you're trying to get that ball into the end zone no matter what. And I think they were probably very successful in quick passing. You know, we've seen a lot of really successful quick passing, and for whatever reason, the Patriots just read it correctly. And the fact that the ball was going to Ricardo Lockett still is, you know, like, even if it gets there, does Ricardo Lockett make that catch? We don't know. If it was a quick pass, I'm sure we would have preferred it have gone to somebody like Doug Baldwin, which, you know, you mentioned Doug Baldwin only having one catch in the Super Bowl. It's like, that's kind of shocking. But it was still, the process was correct.
Yep.
And you just can't judge things based upon the outcomes because you don't know. There's a window of outcomes for everything you do. And if Marshawn Lynch gets a handoff and he fumbles the ball, we're haunted in the same way that we're haunted right now about this interception. So I don't know,
probably haunted just, in a slightly different way actually, but yes,
it's the NFL will always trend to the most conservative outcome, and Pete Carroll has been an extremely conservative coach basically ever since this, you know, and especially for quite a few of the recent years, managed to not do the most thing in the situation, because you're never getting, if he hands the ball off and Marshawn doesn't get in or whatever, incomplete pass, third down or something, they don't score some other way. He's not faulted in the same way, because the way that the NFL works is that you will always be rewarded by doing the most conservative thing. Didn't do that.
Yeah, we lost you for like most of that.
Did you?
Yes.
I cut out?
Yes. Hold on a second.
Really?
Yeah. I'm just making this up.
You're just trying to not give me the MVP. The thing is, the NFL will always trend to the most conservative outcome more than it will the most likely to increase your chances of victory outcome. And in that moment, you laid it out as like the most likely chances of victory weren't necessarily passing. But I think on that individual play,
likely chances of scoring on the next play weren't necessarily passing.
But I think if you look at the entire series of plays, their chances of winning were higher based upon passing.
Yeah. But I think it's more hindsight bias than it is necessarily conservatives. I think that, yeah, if they had given the ball to Marshawn Slay ahead three times.
If they hand off to Marshawn, you fumble, it is not with, like, it's
but
about,
that, but no. Because a fumble is on the player. That's an execution issue. And for some reason, that's different than an interception. But
why?
If Marshawn runs into the line three times and doesn't score, then everyone says, why didn't you pass? Because it's whatever doesn't work the other way automatically would have been
better. Well, they couldn't have run into the line three times.
I'm saying hypothetically, okay? If Belichick calls the timeout there and they run into the line three times, like whatever they don't score, you're going to get criticized. I don't think it would have been the same because it wouldn't have divided the offense and the defense in the way that this play actually ultimately did. But I think he still would have gotten criticized. I don't think it's just a conservatism issue.
It's a combination of both. But the conservatism is part of this conversation. The NFL considers the default play to be a running play forever.
Yeah. I mean, and look, running plays are generally quite successful in short yardage. Like, that's the one situation where you should run a lot.
But when everybody knows what's coming, like... There's just so much playbook where that's where it comes down to. Look, we're always going to say roll Russell Wilson out, but that's what they should have fucking done. Like, if we want to talk about hindsight, you pass the ball and you give Russ the chance to create.
Yeah.
Like, handing the ball off into a line of Patriots who know what's coming wouldn't have been the right decision. And probably this quick pass to Ricardo Lockett wasn't the right decision either. But giving Russ the chance to make something with his legs and run the ball in, or find an there's going to be somebody open if he's rolling out, or he runs it in. One of those two outcomes is so likely. It could have taken longer, and I'm sure they were considering the clock, and maybe that was part of it.
I mean, but with 26 seconds in a timeout, that's not that big of a deal. It's only a big deal if he gets tackled inbounds, but he's Russell Wilson. He's never gotten tackled inbounds in his career.
I think there might have been one time.
Oh.
Maybe it was.
What's
Doug
that
Coleman
you say? Sacks are tackled, really getting tackled in bounds. What's that?
Well,
let's talk about another Seattle football team that had some frustrating losses in Arizona, but not nearly as important. Chris Peterson, his first year as head coach of UW, debuted in a 17-16 win at Hawaii with Jeff Lindquist at quarterback in place of the suspended Siler Miles.
Brutal.
Suspended for an incident after the Super Bowl 2013, where
he was pro Broncos.
It was from Colorado. Assaulted Seahawks fans along with teammate DeMaurier Stringfellow, who transferred afterwards and eventually ended up on the Seahawks practice squad. The Seahawks then came home and, with Miles at QB, escaped to Vernon Adams III 59-52 in a thrilling Week 2 match against Eastern Washington. And finished non-conference play 4-0 before losing their Pac-12 opener to number 16 Stanford at 20-13, a game I don't really have any memory of.
We lost to Stanford at home 20-13.
Yeah.
Or there. Huh.
That was at home, because the year before was on the road.
Oh, I didn't go, because baby-er fantasy genius. So I was at a doctor's appointment. I left halfway through that Eastern game to go to a doctor's appointment. And I was listening to it on the radio, and it's like, this game is fucking wild. First off, I was convinced that Vernon Adams was the second coming of Russell Wilson, and may still be to this day.
I still don't get how it didn't work in Oregon.
That was the scariest thing that ever happened, was Vernon Adams transferring to Oregon. But, well, and that team had, what's his name on it also? Rams wide receiver.
Oh, Cooper Kupp, yeah.
Yeah, there was Cooper Kupp and Vernon Adams. Like, that was a good Eastern team. It wasn't as embarrassing in hindsight for the Huskies defense to be able to do nothing against them.
I mean, I don't know. But, it was a 52. I don't know that they scored 52 points every week against FCS opponents. So it was still a lot, but also partially because the Huskies offense was constantly scoring in that game as well.
Yes. So I was driving to a doctor's appointment in like Kirkland or something, listening to that game on the radio and just being like, Jesus Christ, we're going to lose to Eastern. It's finally happening.
And it was the game with a 57-yard Shaq Thompson touchdown run.
That's what I was going to say. We were pretty pissed about this that year too. They started moving their best defensive player to offense and even just kind of had him running up the middle at some point. Maybe we'll get to that later on in this. But the Stanford game,
I don't know if we're going to get that specific. Also, Kendrick Bourne, who played in the NFL is in the NFL with the 49ers,
still with the 49ers, isn't he? He was out there catching crucial passes this year. Yeah. Kendrick Bourne went to Eastern?
Yeah.
Wow.
That was a good offense, man.
Marco was born on Friday, and that Stanford game happened on Saturday. And so, I don't even know if you went to it. I definitely didn't go.
I'm sure I went to it. Why would I not go?
I feel like you might have been gone for some reason.
I guess that's possible, but I don't remember missing it. Anyways, let's see if we can get Cooper Kupp stats here. 8 catches for 145 yards and 3 touchdowns. Vernon Adams threw 7 touchdowns in that game and 475 yards. Kendrick Bourne had 8 catches for 114 yards and 1 touchdown. So,
oh my god. Those are legit NFL receivers. Roasting the Seahawks NFL receivers.
Okay. Then the Seahawks, that was the start of the Huskies, I should say, losing all 5 conference games versus ranked opponents. They lost at number 9 Oregon, home to number 14 ASU and number 18 UCLA, and then at number 17 Arizona after a late fumble while they were attempting to run out the clock. And the Wildcats ended up scoring after that fumble.
We were a little unconvinced. I think we still generally believed in Coach Pete. But that was the one where it's like they could have taken a knee, time wise. I remember talking about this, and didn't take a knee and chose to run the ball, ended up fumbling, lose the game because of it. That's another team found a worse way to lose in 2014. Exactly. But
technically 2015.
Yes, but this was up there with one of the worst ways to lose.
But the Huskies did go 4-0 against unranked Pac-12 opponents, easily beating Oregon State and Wazoo to finish the season 8-5. They then went back to Arizona and lost the Cactus Bowl 30-22 to an Oklahoma State team with Mason Rudolph at quarterback.
I remember that being a pretty good Oklahoma State team too.
UW men's basketball stayed in its rut.
We can't leave. I mean, this was the beginning of the Chris Peterson era. I think we believed in Coach Pete. The decision to play Shaq Thompson at running back was, in hindsight, a very baffling decision, considering
well,
that
not
he's now
to play him at running back, but just to not play him on defense. Like if you were going to do a Miles Jack situation, like Miles Jack kept playing linebacker.
Yeah,
he just played running back too.
This was a top. Where did he go? He went in the top 10 in the draft, or was he in the top 15? This was a top 15 somewhere. A top 20 first round NFL draft pick as a linebacker that the Huskies
25, I guess.
25, really? It's freaking steal. But that the Huskies saw fit to move to running back, which in hindsight, think about how that sounds. They moved him to running back.
He did run for 174 yards at Colorado.
He had some good games, but he wasn't just a change of pace running back, like get him some carries. It'll be exciting. This wasn't Charles Woodson as a receiver. This was like he was the Huskies running back for periods.
Yeah.
And it was a horrible misuse of Shaq Thompson and his abilities.
I think you're a little more negative on this than you need to be. Shaq Thompson averaged 7.5 yards per carry, man. He was a pretty damn good running back. Oh, boy. But they did have, like, multiple running backs who played in the NFL, LeVon Coleman and Dwayne Washington.
Yeah, that's. I just feel like you're not understanding this. He was a running back. You get him some carries. That was also the year where, that's fun. That's exciting. Like,
that was also the year where John Ross played at defensive back at the end of the year. He started at defensive back, I'm pretty sure, in the bowl game.
Wow, so two first-round picks this season started on the opposite side of the ball.
It was a weird season. This is also Marcus Peters getting kicked off the team mid-year, right?
Was that that same year? It wasn't mid-year. It was like after the Eastern game. He got like a crucial penalty in that Eastern game.
He did, yes. That is correct.
Whew. And I think
a lot of first-round picks doing odd things that year.
So this in Chris Peterson's
he was not kicked off the team until November. He was suspended a game for a sideline tantrum after that penalty against Eastern, I believe.
It was a transition year, is what I'm saying, for Chris Peterson. I mean, obviously, by the next year, he had settled in. He'd gotten his OKGs. He'd settled into the program. But I think he was still figuring out how to use these players for a season.
That's fair. All right, UW men's basketball stayed stuck in the rut. Another rough non-conference with an early home loss to UC Irvine and 7'5" or 7'6" Mamadou Ndiaye in the second game of the season, and a pair of losses at the 2K Classic at Madison Square Garden that I attended, losing badly to Indiana and then also to, I believe, Boston College. They lost at number 24 San Diego State and at home to number 10 UConn, finishing the season 8-5. Again, rallied for a respectable Pac-12 performance. They finished 9-9 in conference play, but lost their Pac-12 tournament opener 67-61 to Utah and did not play in the postseason.
Ugh.
The Sounders, with maybe the best team in franchise history, even though it didn't win the MLS Cup.
Wow.
Winning the U.S. Open Cup in the Supporters Shield in 2014. They played all the preliminary games of the U.S. Open Cup at Starfire, beating San Jose on penalties and Portland 3-1 in extra time before crushing Chicago 6-0 in the semis. They then won the final 3-1 at Philadelphia again in extra time. The Sounders beat the Galaxy 2-0 in the regular season finale after coming up with a 2-2 draw the previous week down in Carson against the Galaxy to clinch the first and still only Supporters Shield in franchise history, behind the dominant attack of Obafemi Martins, who had 17 goals, and Clint Dempsey, who had 15, plus 9 from Lamar Nagel.
Wow.
Good for Lamar Nagel. But, I mean, this was, like, the best 1-2 combination in Sounders history.
Man, I kind of forgot Martins. Was this his... He played a few more years with the team after this, right?
Yes.
Or at least one more season. That was a pretty dominant attack.
Yeah. In the first round... The offense was not necessarily there for the Sounders, but they got a win over Dallas on the road goal tiebreaker because they drew 1-1 on the roads and then drew 0-0 at home before losing to the Galaxy on the same tiebreaker in the West Final, giving up the tying goal in the 54th minute after going up 2-0 in the first half of the home leg.
Ugh.
This also, by the way, notably 2014, was one of the World Cups we paid most attention to. It was the Men in Blazers World Cup.
Was it 2014?
Yeah.
Was the Men in Blazers World Cup?
That was Brazil.
Was Italy in this World Cup?
I believe Italy was in this World Cup.
It was 18 that Italy didn't go. Yes, they flamed out in the first round. This one.
14 was the year that there was the biting incident with Chiellini and Suarez.
And the U.S. like managed to escape and advance to the knockout stages of this one, right?
Correct. And then they had the game where they lost to Belgium, despite Tim Howard coming up with like 24 saves.
Yeah, Belgium. Spectacular that was number. Excellent Belgium team.
Yeah, I believe. Got the winning goal on that one.
It wasn't Lukaku?
It was Lukaku, yeah.
That was really a disgrace. The biting incident happening for Italy. Italy just kind of, in the World Cup, is usually when they are eligible, just kind of around stuff. Stuff is happening.
I guess that's true.
In that World Cup. That is
undoubtedly true.
But I remember this being a fun... Who is the host country?
Brazil.
Oh, it was in Brazil.
Who then that year in the semis... gave up what, like 6 goals to 8 goals or whatever to Germany?
Oh yeah, they got destroyed.
Yeah, Lukaku in the 105th minute with the winner, or the second goal. I guess De Bruyne actually gave them the lead. Uh-huh. The U.S. didn't pull one back through Julian Green until the 107th minute shortly after.
Julian Green. So this was the final that was Argentina, Germany, and then Germany ended up winning.
Correct.
Yeah, this was one of the World Cup. This is a good World Cup, actually.
7-1 was that Germany-Brazil score.
Oh, man. Yeah, this was a fun summer for soccer.
The Seattle Storm playoff streak was snapped at 10 in 2014. They started the season hoping to contend after trading a first-round pick to add Crystal Langhorne as a replacement for the retired Tina Thompson, with Subaru back on the court. But they began the campaign 1-5 and were 9-13 in mid-July when the bottom fell out with a 7-game losing streak. They finished 12-22, tied for the worst record in the WNBA with the Tulsa Shock. It was a better summer for the Seattle Mariners, who just missed the playoffs. They led the AL, giving up 3.42 runs per game.
Not sure if that's a good thing or not, just missing the playoffs.
Sure. By Mariners standards, that's a celebration. Felix had another dominant season. Hisashi, Iwakuma, Chris Young, and Ronis Elias, all under 4 ERA, and then an excellent bullpen, and they got just enough offense from newcomer Robinson Cano and Kyle Seager, who ended the season's final day 1 game back of the Oakland A's for the new second wild card spot. But Oakland beat Texas 4-0 to clinch the spot and eliminate the Mariners.
Oh, I think we were paying attention to this. I think we were really monitoring baseball closely for that last month or so.
There was a Seahawks game going on at the same time. I remember going back and forth.
That last one. Yeah, I think 2014 was the most in that we've been on baseball. So I guess it was a good year by Mariner standards.
Yeah, 16 we were pretty in.
Were we pretty in 16? I don't, they all run together.
16 was the year they got eliminated on the Saturday night before the final day of the season.
Wow.
And I remember
the Mariners sure have been close to making the playoffs.
As soon as they expanded it to like 8 wild cards, they got competitive. But I remember listening to that game driving back from Kevin Durant's first preseason game with the Warriors in Vancouver.
Oh, wow. You're really just name-dropping all the arenas you've been to on this podcast.
Let's remember some arenas.
Like, all of us would like to have been to Vancouver. I'm sure you probably ate some excellent food there, too.
Yeah.
Sure,
I didn't get dumplings, though, so in hindsight, there was a missed opportunity to get some Tim Hortons. 2014 saw the Blazers win a playoff series.
There we go.
They added Robin Lopez via trade and strengthened the bench with Mo Williams, improving dramatically on both ends of the court, moving to second in offensive rating and league average on defense, and by 21 total wins, earning the 5th seed in the Western Conference, as Damian Lillard joined LaMarcus Aldridge as All-Stars. The Blazers won the first 2 games of their first-round matchup in Houston, then split in Portland, and came back home to win the series on Damian Lillard's walk-off 3 in Game 6.
This was the coolest walk-off until Dame Lillard's other coolest walk-off.
I mean, it's interesting because, obviously that one holds more personal significance to us. The Houston one, though, in some ways because it had been so long since the Blazers won a playoff series, and also because it was Game 6 and they were going to have to go to Houston for Game 7, and they were down. Like, the Paul George shot, they were tied. So you add those factors, I think it's on a non-emotional level, it was a bigger shot.
Do you think it's just to us in Seattle that the beating the Thunder shot was a bigger shot, though? Like, I feel like that's remembered as one of the great moments in Blazers history.
It is. I mean, also the fact that they eventually did get to the conference finals. But there's also a recency element to it. I mean, they're both remembered quite fondly in Portland. My memory of this series, I don't know how much we want to step on. No, I guess this doesn't step on anything.
what are you going to step on?
Well, I had a story about Silicon Valley that is tangentially connected to this.
Okay.
Games 3 and 4 of the series, we were in Austin at our friend Nick's wedding. Do you recall that?
Yeah, no, I'm ready to talk about. I feel like a lot happened in our personal lives in 2014.
Yeah, I suppose so. Oh, that's right. I had forgotten about the Hawaii trip.
Getting jobs, traveling, going to Hawaii, having children. I did all the things in 2014.
You really did. I guess only game three. Technically, we flew back just in time for game four of that series. But yeah, we flew into Austin on a Thursday night, went to some bar and drank Shiner on the patio.
We went to the, oh my God, purple, well, I can't remember. I became incredibly ill.
Yeah. But then we went to Veracruz Tacos.
Yeah, and we got the Veracruz Tacos, and then went to the bar with the tacos.
Did we?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure we got those first, and then went to the bar with the tacos, and I like couldn't even eat them. I was getting so sick. It was what are the big lights called in Austin? You know, or the towers that you climb up?
I don't know.
They're in Dazed and Confused.
To where they go to have the party?
Yeah. They're called like the Moon Towers.
I did not see that into my half-ass internet research on the
Moonlight Towers. I can't remember what that bar is called. Anyway, it was the best bar in Austin. I fucking loved it. It was a great bar, like right on the east side of Austin, before Rainy Street became a thing. And you know, Rainy Street now is like it's like the Ballard or whatever of Austin. But this was like the east side was the coolest part of Austin at the time. There was this bar that was central there. It was called like the Purple Something, and it was awesome. And they had massive back patio, and you're just like,
yeah.
Every day in Austin is great to be outside. So at least when I've been there, having only been there in March and this trip in June.
April. No, this was April.
Or in April. Yeah,
I've been to Texas in late May. It was not that great to be outside in Texas in late May. So the Friday we went to Torchy's Tacos. Mm-hmm. Hung out with Kirk Goldsberry.
With Kirk Goldsberry.
Saturday we went to what's the barbecue place we went to?
We went to Salt Lake, the pilgrimage to the greatest barbecue on earth, possibly.
Not the best barbecue I've had.
I can't even give an objective opinion about it because I was so ill.
That's true. You were still struggling. That was the day of the wedding.
That was the day of the wedding.
Yeah.
I think that was I don't even remember which day I was.
Oh, and that morning we woke up and the Donald Sterling news had broken.
Yes.
So that was a weird thing hanging over that entire day. Then Sunday we went and ate breakfast tacos with your friend in Austin.
Oh yeah. With Chase Clancy.
and then went to a bar with Kirk and his NBA Nerd Night group to watch the playoffs and drink Lone Stars.
God, that was awesome. I think I was feeling a little bit better by the time we went to that bar. But yeah, the place that we went to with Chase also was awesome too. We had like, they had like 40 different flavors of margaritas. God, Austin's the best. I'm so upset that I didn't get to go to Austin this year.
I mean, number one, I want to go anywhere, but I really want to go to Austin.
Number one,
again.
I want to go anywhere. Ah, just fucking anywhere. Bullshit we didn't get to go to Austin. My body needs tacos.
Sadly, unavailable here in Seattle. But I remember you on the flight home were reading some magazine that had Silicon Valley stars on the cover. And that was the first time I remember
Entertainment Weekly, I'm guessing?
Probably being aware of Silicon Valley, which we're going to talk about in a second here.
That whole trip was like, I don't know, that time period. So I just interviewed for a new job. And was anticipating that I would get it. I interviewed when we were in Hawaii because we went to Hawaii in March, or I guess early April.
Yeah, because I celebrated my birthday there.
And you recorded the first ever Zach Lowe podcast, first ever Lowe post.
Number three.
Was it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the first ever Lowe post, if anybody asks.
Oh, okay.
It was the Kemba Walker UConn team, right? Where Kemba led UConn to the championship.
It was not the Kemba Walker UConn team. Kemba Walker was long in the NBA by then.
Who was the
Shabazz Napier?
Oh, Shabazz. UConn team. Okay. Yeah, it's like I knew that there was a UConn player who like put the team on their back, and we were in Hawaii, and that game happened at like 1 p.m. or whatever.
Very odd. I was the only one who stayed in the room and watched it. You guys all went to the beach.
Yeah, we made the right decision. You stayed inside and watched college basketball. Think about that.
I mean, it was a great view still.
Oh, I want to be in Hawaii right now.
Just anywhere. Did you go to Vegas that year, too?
Probably. Oh, we definitely did go to Vegas
that year. I think that was the year I went down below. I went before I went to Summer League.
Maybe it was the next year that we went with Chris, and I stayed out with him until like 7 in the morning when we first played craps. I think that was 2015.
Sounds right.
Okay, we'll reminisce about that next year.
Okay.
So we went to Hawaii for like 9 days. I'd interviewed for a new job in Hawaii and then did like an in-person interview right before we went to Austin, and then went to Austin and then eventually was like offered the job. So like transitions to the music that came out this year, because it was like all of a sudden I'm at this place that's working with these artists in the indie rock realm who are putting out. I remember Kurt Goldsberry being like, you might be a good person to know soon or whatever. And I was like, hey, that's kind of a shitty thing to say. Because it's like, you can just actually know me now, whether I'm connected to explosions in the sky or whatever. But like the being going to there in that moment for indie rock, it was coming off like Arcade Fire and Bon Iver both winning Grammys for best record of the year. And then Future Islands, who had just the Letterman moment had happened that spring. And it was like, everything was happening for Future Islands. They went from being, you know, relatively small touring band to being massive band basically overnight because of this Letterman performance, and performing the song Seasons. And it's like, that song to me is the defining song of all of 2014.
Interesting. I think what stands out about 2014 is, like, if you think of the biggest artists of the 2010s, almost none of them put out albums in 2014. Like, all of them did in 2013 when we were talking. Mm-hmm. But, like, there was no Jay-Z, there was no Drake, there was no Rihanna, there was no Beyonce. Kendrick didn't put out an album, although he did have perhaps one of the songs of the year, because the single I came out ahead of his album in 2015.
Yes, but, which was never, like, the real version was never, or the original single version was never on To Pimp a Butterfly. It was a remix version that was on To Pimp a Butterfly.
Gotcha. So yeah, so I definitely think that kind of made room for like this different group to, you know, rise up.
Well, the other artists, when we were driving around in Austin, the two songs, because we were listening to just whatever pop radio, was Happy by Pharrell from the Minions movie.
See, I connect Pharrell Happy to the 2014 All-Star game I attended in New Orleans, where it felt like that was the
another
song of the
arena you've been to.
It's true. It's true.
So it was that, and then the song Fancy by Iggy Azalea.
Oh, wow.
I'm telling you, we were driving around in that rental car in the middle of fucking driving out to nowhere, Texas, and those two tracks were playing every six songs.
It was too early to really be able to connect via Bluetooth to the stereo, I guess.
I wish we would have. Oh, and there was, oh my God, what was that other song? Just the Way You Are.
Is that... I mean, that's a 2013 song, but it may still have been okay, popular in 2014. It's on the playlist.
I remember hearing those three repeatedly while we were driving out to Salt Lake in Texas, because it's like an hour outside of town.
Well, no, but we were staying pretty close. It was only like a 15 to 20 minute drive from the hotel where we were staying.
To Salt Lake?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. We were driving to the hotel, and it was like an hour outside of town.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yes, yes. Besides Future Islands, I would say also a big year for the War on Drugs.
Absolutely. That was the year that the War on Drugs became, like, you know, they moved out of, like, band that was affiliated with Kurt Vile and became much bigger than Kurt Vile on their own. I remember reading an interview where "We're on Drugs, Dude," Johnny something. it was like a long piece where he was talking about like coping with depression and how he was like using colors to define the art after that. And I was like, this is fucking cool. This. And then also getting to work with St. Vincent that year, where St. Vincent had kind of like the breakout for St. Vincent. She was already cool, but like her working with Perfume Genius in that year, there was like records that were extremely exciting happening all around me all of a sudden, where it was like, you know, I'm not actually connected to these artists really in any sort of like close or tangible way, but it was like all of a sudden on the team of these like huge indie rock artists, and it was very different from where I was before.
I also feel like, was there a story about Carrie Brownstein like calling and you answering or something like that? Am I recalling that correctly?
Annie Clark and Carrie Brownstein would call often, because the owner of the company at the time managed Slater Kinney, and Slater Kinney was in the process of coming back. So he managed both Slater Kinney and St. Vincent. And so they would call often. There was no real story, but it was just like, sometimes you'd answer the phone. You'd be like, wow, that is a very famous person. And Carrie Brownstein had become much more famous than, you know, cause this was on the heels, like Portlandia was huge at the time. Yes. And she was like, hey, this is Carrie for Botch. And you're just like, sending you through. You don't need to, most people you're just like, and what is it regarding or whatever. That was not something that you were doing with Annie or Carrie. Or sometimes, I think Carrie and Lowell was probably 2015.
Yes.
But you get the occasional like, hey, this is Sufjan. And you're just like, hold on a second.
Oh, we can talk about hanging backstage with Sufjan next year.
Oh, man. Oh, yeah. That was really cool. Really cool stuff. Being in the biz and getting to awkwardly be around Sufjan Stevens.
Well, some of us got to be even more awkward because we weren't in the biz. We were just there.
Just a guy who was there.
The brother of the guy who's there.
The brother of the guy who happens to know Sufjan's agent. Oh man.
Anything else you want to highlight musically from 2014?
The Salad Days record by Mac DeMarco. Whereas like Mac DeMarco was already, he wasn't actually that huge. And Mac DeMarco, in hindsight, you might not know this, but he is the voice of a generation.
Which generation?
Just a generation. It's a micro generation. No, there are so many kids. Mac DeMarco is legit one of the most influential artists of the last 10 years. And there are so many kids who are like, he's number one of who has influenced them to make music. And it's something that like, if you're from the outside, you might not even recognize, but this record in particular, Salad Days, I went to the show at Chop Suey after it came out, and it was like, he could do no wrong on that record. The whole thing was perfect. He was like crowd surfing. He was like playing the guitar behind his head. It was like ridiculous. He should have never been playing a venue that size at that point. Like Mac DeMarco was way too big for that. And it was an awesome experience. So that to me was like, it was the not the Mac DeMarco moment, because again, Mac DeMarco now, the influence is outsized with the generation that came after it, but this is the music that I think was really influencing them, and like when most people were discovering it.
This was the first year we did a top 10. Do we want to go over that?
Sure, quickly.
Maybe some highlights. My number one song was Love Me Harder by Ariana Grande and The Weeknd.
I don't even know the song. Love Me Harder by Ariana Grande and The Weeknd.
It's a huge song. You do. They played it on
SNL. Was this the year we went to Bumbershoot and saw The Weeknd?
I don't think so. But I can't rule that out for certain. Let's see. I also had I in there in the top five. Oh, Stay With Me. That was a big Sam Smith moment.
Oh, wow. This was a big Sam Smith moment.
You had C Seasons, number one, of course. Under the Pressure, number two.
God, that song's still so good.
Hollywood by Tobias Gesso Jr., number three.
Wow. Snapshot of 2014. The Tobias Gesso Jr. moment never really happened. But if you would have asked me in 2014 who today would be the biggest artist from that list, I would have been like, oh, definitely Tobias Gesso Jr.
We also didn't talk about Caribou that you have in your top 10.
Oh, man, can't do without hearing that song for the first time ever. It was – and, you know, he'd been recording music for quite a long time at that point. but I think I was looking at Pitchfork because it was 2014, and the Future Islands, it was like there was a headline that was like Letterman trying to make Future Islands performance a thing. It was like the headline. And then that same day, there was like the track section and Can't Do Without by Caribou came out, and just turning it on for the first time, being like, oh, I can't believe this wasn't in your top 10 for that year. The track's incredible.
I am surprised. I think, well, I know that I in my preliminary list of 2020 consideration, there's a Caribou song from the album they put out this year.
Wow.
I'm reveal that.
You're already making 2020 lists? We haven't done our like top five.
I like to always just have some tracks under consideration. I went through and actually, so the way I've been like going through the Wikipedia page of albums per year and like listening to the most notable ones, I did that with 2020 this week since I had some extra time. So that was interesting. Also for the record, the order of Low Post Podcast Cats was Ornovitz, Mark Stein, and then me.
Wow.
So it was number three.
You have to bring yourself back down to earth after you've gloated about all the arenas you've been to.
It's really not that remarkable to have been to a lot of arenas. Many people have done it. It's called being a beat writer. You go to all the arenas pretty quickly. I haven't been to like, I'm still barely over half. Let's talk about TV in 2014. There, as mentioned,
Energy Arena might be, the name might be changing soon.
Silicon Valley came on the scene and was an immediate tour de force.
And tour de force?
Yeah, you heard
wow.
me.
Wow.
I have spoken.
I remember, you know, I feel like, so you should talk about Silicon Valley, because I've always been like arm's length. I've seen every single episode of Silicon Valley, but if I might have missed, was there a season this year?
The finale was last summer or fallish.
Okay, I think I might have watched that. I'm not sure. I might have missed the last season of Silicon Valley, but it was never like my favorite TV show, and I always felt sort of like, I don't know. There's.
You felt about it the way you feel about Silicon Valley?
Kind of, where it's like Silicon Valley is more sinister in a lot of ways than the show is letting on. And I feel like the show
itself...
I don't
know that the show is not letting on that.
But it was more just like...
I think the show is occasionally being very explicit about that.
When those parts I think were better. I think over time it grew, but there was like, just like, people are nerdy here. Like, that is not as funny to me as, you know, like, I don't know. I
mean, it started out with all of them saying we're trying to change the world.
But it's like, yeah, that's funny, and you're like making fun of people, but it's just like there is a seriousness to what is happening, you know, and some of the like racial inequality that's happening and gender inequality that's happening in Silicon Valley that is... These are much larger issues, and how wealth is not being divided.
The concept of satire.
But I'm saying,
is that a concept you're aware of?
Sometimes when you're just like minimize it down to things where it's just like this, what is happening is not okay. But you're just like, and these people are nerdy. Like that part of it is just like
that's much of a joke. You haven't even watched this show. I stopped talking about Silicon Valley because you apparently have never watched it. You just said you didn't watch the final season.
I'm sure that changed everything. I'm pretty sure I did watch the final season, though. But also Camille Nanciani, come on.
Yeah. Well, we already loved
Speaking
him from
of Tour de Forces.
2014 was the True Detective season 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
Really, any thoughts on that?
I mean, it was really not a fun TV show. It's funny that I'm talking about Silicon Valley and I'm like just making light of serious things. And I'm like, True Detective, too serious, bleak.
One of my favorite shows came on the scene in You're the Worst, which also wrapped up last year and was like such a strange thing for me to be into, I would say, in some ways, but also really hilarious.
Was this the Sufjan Stevens soup?
Yes.
Show?
Yes.
I've never seen an episode of it, but I have some thoughts.
Yeah, you're going to say they didn't tackle enough serious issues either. Also, BoJack Horseman?
I think I was actually thinking of BoJack Horseman a couple weeks ago in light of the, you know, of both racial inequality that exists throughout Hollywood and how, as a show, in season one, they have Alison Brie as a white actress playing an Asian character, and Diane Wynn. But, like, over time, I feel like, as a show, really went out of its way. I'm assuming this is the only time we're going to talk about BoJack Horseman. went out of its way to cast, like, a diverse cast of characters. I mean, they're all animated. But, like, introducing young comedians and a diverse cast in different roles where it wasn't like people of color typecast into certain characters or something. It wasn't like certain characters are like traditional roles. I feel like BoJack Horseman really worked to break some of those racial stereotypes that exist. And then also had a long theme about being asexual, which has never been discussed as far as I know in basically any television show. And for being when at its core element is a TV show about an animated show about a anthropomorphic horse who is like a Bob Saget type character in Full House. When you get to those next steps of it, it's just like, it was a pretty impressive TV show. And also, like, in the end, funny, but, you know, a serious TV show, ultimately. And also kind of bleak, but, like, felt like it really balanced the tone of both. You know, it was able to criticize Hollywood in a way that didn't feel like it was reducing. It was like Silicon Valley, where they were, like, not taking the issues serious enough.
Satirizing, again, is the word you're looking for. Satirizing.
I still, you know, Silicon Valley, it's a good show.
You know, every once in a while, people ask the question, hey, what's the worst TV show that you've seen all the episodes for? And the answer for us is probably something like Shasta McNasty.
Have you seen every episode of Shasta McNasty? I definitely.
How would I know at this point? How can I keep track? But as an adult, of shows that I know that I have seen every episode of, my answer to that is Mulaney.
It's that bad?
It wasn't great, but it was just like I kept sticking with it. Even after it got canceled, I watched all those episodes off my DVR. So that is the worst show I've ever watched all the episodes of.
I've never seen an episode of Mulaney, but why was it so bad?
I don't know. It just didn't work. Just something didn't click about it. I mean, I love his stand-up, which is why I was interested in it in the first place. Also, probably at that point, I don't know if I'd seen as much of the stand-up. It was actually probably more based on some podcast he did that I listened to and knowing that he was behind the Stefan sketches on SNL.
I swear I knew nothing about John Mulaney until like 2018.
I mean, also liking Nassim Pedrad, who was in that, and she was a co-star in that one.
It was a day where I was just like, somebody was talking about John Mulaney sold out like 10 nights at some venue in Chicago. And I was like, who the fuck? I was like, he did what now? John Mulaney sold 20,000 tickets? And I was like, oh, actually, John Mulaney is the most famous comedian there is. I was like, the guy from that show that Al watches?
I don't know if I was bringing up the lady a lot.
We definitely talked about it in 2014 at some point, where you were like, I don't even know the premise. I know nothing about the show, but I know that John Mulaney has been involved with a lot of really successful and really good television since then. So I'm really just baffled why this didn't work.
Me too. I think so. It's John Mulaney, for that matter. Sometimes it just doesn't work. All right, 2014 in movies. Boyhood was like a movie I sought out in the theater, which was pretty rare at this point in my life, and just loved it immensely.
Wow.
Big Austin year.
Yeah, that was.
Also, somehow, we talked about this, I think, when we talked about The Suburbs. Somehow, the soundtrack to a movie that did not yet exist.
It's pretty incredible.
Although I guess it did exist. It was already being made.
That this they wrote the record that kind of sounds like this movie. Having those two happen in conjunction with each other in not consecutive years, but such a close proximity. And that Arcade Fire happened to be the biggest indie rock band in the world while this movie was coming out and from Austin or from Texas is pretty incredible how that ended up working out. Maybe not from, but having roots in Texas.
Yes. Also worth mentioning here, if we're talking about music, is the compilation of post-Beatles solo work that Ethan Hawke actually put together that is in this movie. And I don't know why now I can't remember the name of the...
Post-Beatles solo work?
Yeah.
He made a compilation of, like, the solo members of the Beatles.
Okay, the Black Album is what he calls it. Yeah, and you can find that on Spotify. I've listened to that.
He calls it the Black Album.
Yeah.
As if Metallica and Jay-Z don't exist.
I think it's just the opposite of their White Album.
Oh, I guess I get it. Huh. I'm unaware of any of this. He talks about that in the movie?
Yeah, he gives it to his son in the movie.
Oh. Huh. I guess I've never seen it. No, I don't know. It's been 6 years. I've had like 12 children since this time.
That's true. 2014, we've already talked about it. Draft Day.
Oh, speaking of tour de forces, Tours de Force.
It's actually Tour de Force, but the S is silent now because it's plural.
They all have S's on them, each word, but they're all silent.
Quarter pounder with cheeses.
Oh, man.
Anything else on 2014 movies?
I don't know. I haven't dug deep enough on it.
Okay.
No. I still want to hear you defend Silicon Valley, though. Like, what?
I just don't understand how you think they're not making, like, satirizing again these issues. Like, their head of their fake Google is clearly totally evil. Do you not see that? Did you not get that?
You think they're a fake Google? Because I always imagine him as a Steve Gavin Belson we're talking about here.
Yeah.
I always imagined him as a Steve Jobs type.
No, I don't think he's supposed to be a Steve Jobs type. Because he's not creative at all. I don't think he's like any one specific person from Google. He's an amalgamation of different characters. I mean, the one thing that we'll always wonder about at Silicon Valley is if the character who played their angel investor hadn't passed away after season one, how different would it have been? Christopher Evan Welch, who played Peter Gregory.
Yes.
So.
I think part of it was
just
like...
And a Seattle native.
Oh, really?
Christopher Evan Welch.
Oh, yeah. How about that? It was similar to the Brooklyn Nine-Nine thing that I mentioned, though, where I was just like, I'm having a hard time getting past this. And watching every single episode. But also, we're talking, you got Martin Starr out there, you know what I mean? You got Camille Nanjiani. Look, I'm obviously going to watch Big Head.
Yes. All right. Well, on that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.